headlines. Iran's leader calls for an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the country is the victim of the U.S. policy of creating crises. Russia says it sees, quote, no desire on the part of Ukraine to try to find a legitimate and balanced solution to the problems between the two countries. And as a global outcry over the brutal treatment of indigenous people in Canada is still fresh, 169 new potential graves are found at the site of a former residential school. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for an end to the war in Ukraine and singled out the U.S. and its policies as the main culprit for the crisis.
در صورتی ممکنه که ریشه بحران شناخته بشه ریشه بحران در اوکراین سیاست‌های آمریکاست سیاست‌های غربی است اینها ریشه بحرانه اینا رو باید شناخت و بر اساس اینها قضاوت کرد داوری کرد و اگر اهل اقدام بودیم اقدام کرد
آیت‌الله سید علی خامنه‌ای noted that the US feeds on crises and makes around the world. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is nothing but a mirage. He recalled how the Ukrainian president and former Afghan president both acknowledged being abandoned by Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei called the U.S. government a mafia regime, saying Western nations use science to slaughter and plunder other nations. He said Washington is a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance. Leader was delivering a speech on the occasion of Eid al-Mapas, the day the Holy Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's messenger. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement warns ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine could have serious repercussions globally. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that Moscow-Kiev tensions are very dangerous. He believes conflict is more than just a face-off between Russia and Ukraine and has the potential to draw in the rest of the world. Lebanese resistance chief also blasted the West for its double standard approach toward Russia. He questioned the role of the international community at a time when the U.S. is waging wars against Iraq and Afghanistan. Nasrallah said that Washington is responsible for what's happening in Ukraine and that the Ukrainian people are the ones who are paying the price for this conflict. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its seventh day, with major cities including the capital Kiev being targets of attacks. An airstrike on Kiev's main television tower killed five people, knocked out some state broadcasting. Satellite images show Russian tanks and armored vehicles moving toward the city. Convoy stretches for more than 65 kilometers. In the Black Sea city of Kherson, the Russian army has set up checkpoints. Meanwhile, in Kharkiv, a central square was shelled by advancing Russian forces. Ukraine's emergency services say the attack left 10 people dead. Eight others were also killed in an airstrike on a housing block in the city. Meanwhile, Russia's defense minister has vowed to push ahead with the operation until Moscow's objectives are achieved. Moscow accuses Kiev of not showing any desire to find a legitimate and balanced solution to the ongoing conflict. Now, Russia's ambassador to the UN in Geneva says his country supports equality and respect-based diplomacy, but does not see the same approach from Kiev. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president has told his U.S. counterpart that we must stop the aggressor as soon as possible. Vladimir Zelensky has called on NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine, but the alliance has rejected the request. Zelensky says his country will demand legally binding security guarantees if NATO rules out the possibility of Kiev joining the organization. And he also says Russia needs to stop bombing the country's cities before any meaningful talks on a ceasefire can start. Western countries are piling up pressure on Russia as Moscow pushes ahead with its military operation in Ukraine. The West has sought to cripple Russia's banking sector with a barrage of sanctions. In one of the latest measures, the European Union banned selected Russian banks from the SWIFT global payment system. The sanctions have led Russia's national currency to hit record lows against the dollar. In response, the Russian government has ordered emergency capital controls, including a ban on cash exports of foreign currency exceeding $10,000 in value. EU has also banned Russian state media outlets RT and Sputnik from broadcasting in the bloc. The European Council says sanctions against Moscow have been massive and unprecedented.
We have responded with massive and unprecedented sanctions. We imposed sanctions on political and military leaders, on oligarchs, on Vladimir Putin, on Sergei Lavrov. We are also taking powerful measures to severely restrict the use of the foreign currency reserve of the Russian Central Bank. We are excluding key Russian banks from the SWIFT system. And we are also imposing severe sanctions on key sectors of Russia's economy.
The West sanctions have also targeted Russia's energy sector. Britain and Canada have barred Russia-linked vessels from entering their ports. UK has also warned that removing Russia is one of five permanent members of the UN Security Council is among options on the table. More than a dozen European countries, as well as Canada, have also closed their airspace to Russia. In retaliation, Russia has shut off all 27 EU nations, as well as Britain and Canada, from its airspace. The US has also expelled a dozen Russian diplomats in the country's UN mission. Russia has vowed to retaliate, saying it will not yield to sanctions and pressure. This comes as the UN's International Court of Justice says it will hold public hearings early next week over a lawsuit filed by Ukraine seeking a halt to Moscow's offensive. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank say they are racing to provide billions of dollars of additional funding to Ukraine in the coming weeks. News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Israeli forces killed a third Palestinian in the West Bank in less than 24 hours as tensions run high in occupied territories. Amar Shafiq Abu Afifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces are refusing to hand over his body to Palestinians. Earlier in the day, Israeli forces killed two other Palestinians in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Tuesday was declared a day of rage in Palestine, with demonstrations held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Protests were held in Ramallah, Tulkarm, and Bethlehem, among other cities and towns. Israeli forces clashed with demonstrators in Al-Khalil and Beit Umar.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children, and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Joining us now for the program is Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario, and Lawrence Davison, former lecturer out of Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Lawrence Davison, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well. Now, Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian protesters over the last day. My question to you, we don't hear anything about it out of the international community. We don't hear about the guy with the big guns taking advantage of the guy with little guns or no guns taking his land, but we hear an awful lot about Russia with the big guns going in against a beleaguered military there in the Ukrainian army, and everybody's hearts are supposed to pour out for, Ukrainians. Why not Palestinians?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. there was a host on one of the programs of MSNBC who actually came out on the air and said that American credibility in this case is not very good because of the hypocrisy, one of which, of course, is that we support, the taking of land as long as the people who are taking it as our allies. When it comes to the shootings, I think it's very important to understand that these shootings are not just individual soldiers acting out, but these shootings essentially are policy. The soldiers know that they can't, that they're not going to be punished, and so what we've got here is a unwritten yet official policy that if you think that you can get a good shot at a Palestinian demonstrator, you take it. It's not only an unwritten but official policy of the army, but it's a publicly supported policy too. I think that the bulk of the Israeli, the Jewish Israeli population doesn't care. I mean, so these guys can shoot anybody they want, and nobody, and they're sort of semi-heroes. And it's also the case that not only does the Israeli public not care, but the Western political establishment doesn't care. And that's right. Why this will go on forever. I mean, not forever, but indefinitely.
Robert Fantina, welcome to the program. Why is that? The Western politicians really don't care about Palestinians. I mean, the value of a human life in the eyes of the Western world, is it defined by what? Geography, by race, by religion, by according to Larry, allied support? What's going on here?
There are a few issues. One, of course, is that Western powers, especially the United States, will allow their allies to do whatever they want to, regardless of how many international laws it violates, how many crimes against humanity are committed, and regardless of the abominable repression of human rights. Part of the thing we see that's different between the Russian bombardment of the Ukraine and Israel's ongoing repression of the Palestinians is that the Palestinians are mainly Muslims. It's mainly a Muslim nation, and there is a tremendous amount of prejudice against Muslims in the United States and other Western countries as well. They're seen as somehow not of the same value as whites of European descent. So we have in the Ukraine, which has a small but not a significant Muslim population, and so the people there that are being bombed and shot, this is a horrible thing. When those same things happen to Palestinians, well, it's Israel defending itself. I don't know why the U.S. government isn't justifying Russia's actions by saying Russia is defending itself. It's similar, although it's more extreme in the situation with Israel and Palestine, because the Palestinian people have every right under international law to resist. You mentioned earlier the fact that more punitive measures have been taken against prisoners since the breakout of several prisoners a few months ago. This is collective punishment, violation of international law, but the Western governments aren't saying anything about it. There's been a lot of publicity about some six-year-old girl who was killed in Ukraine. Terrible, horrible, and tragic event. But children are killed in Palestine on a regular basis. We don't hear about it. So there is a lot of, it's partly due to the politics and who countries are allied with. It's partly due to religion, certainly, and ethnicity. But it's, no matter what it's attributed to, it is completely unfair and unjust.
Thank you, gentlemen. Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of more unmarked graves of Native children. An Indigenous community has now identified 169 potential unmarked graves at another former residential school site northwest of Edmonton. The discovery brings the total number of such graves found so far to more than 1,500. The country's authorities forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where they were subjected to physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. The church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. And that's it for your latest, everyone. And bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Not race, not religion, but the animating force of the Zionist regime denying the basic rights of Halabi and countless other Palestinians has no place in the world, says Paul Salvatore Ryder in an article titled Israeli regime must end unjustified incarceration of Palestinian humanitarian worker Al Halabi. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime continues to detain, contrary to international law, former World Vision Canada WVC aid worker Muhammad Al-Halabi. He has been in prison now for over 5 years without any formal charges, and last week had yet another hearing. There have been upwards of 160 in an Israeli regime court. They decided against his 23rd request to keep him in prison. Al-Halabi is the exact opposite of a terrorist supporter, which the Israeli regime is falsely trying to paint him as. As echoed by World Vision itself, Al-Halabi is an exemplary humanitarian who, while working for World Vision, committed himself to offset the pain and suffering of Gazans caused by the Zionist regime. Workers like him help ensure Palestinians have enough to drink, eat, electricity to run their modest household, can relatively safely attend a school. They are dedicated to protecting or enhancing life to at least a basic degree of dignity where there would otherwise be dead. Matter is perhaps the better word. Deprivation of life resources, such as the blockade by the territory, is a deliberate measure of the Zionist regime. The Israelis want innocent Palestinians to die while the rest of the world remains blind to that or, if they see, say nothing about it. If they do, they are threatened with the label anti-Semitic. The Zionist regime has failed to provide any compelling evidence whatsoever that implicates Al-Halabi as financially aiding the terroristic activities. This is what the Zionist regime is trying to convince the world he has done, even though the money that they are accusing him of funneling surpasses what would have ever been available to him, let alone WVC. It is not surprising that the Zionist regime continues to lie about pro-Palestinians. The question, however, remains why they are doing so in Al-Halabi's case and to what end. This is what's happening, in that uncanny way that life sometimes imitates are and vice versa in Al-Halabi's case. The Zionist regime's judicial system, instead of guaranteeing him a trial where he is presumed innocent to prove otherwise, is already punishing him. Since his arrest, he has experienced a host of sanctioned injustices that no democracy would ever allow. Denied legal counsel, torture, forcibly pressured by the prosecution to which Al-Halabi did not submit to plead guilty, prevented from having UN and other international bodies ensure the fairness of his trial. Forgoing any due process whatsoever, this is vengeance exacted on an innocent person. He is a threat to the Zionist regime because he is a humanitarian. What's happening to Al-Halabi cannot be fully grasped or understood in isolation. It must be seen as part of a larger campaign by the Zionist regime to make examples of those brave and courageous enough to help the Palestinian people in accordance with international law and respect for human rights. Those who do, even if that means mitigating the effects of senseless violence, a humanitarian rather than express political act, will ultimately have to pay. For Al-Halabi, the cost has been his freedom. The Zionist regime does not want Palestinians as part of its future because they cannot come right out and say that as that would only further stoke the indignation of the international community towards it. The Zionist regime has to provide a justification for incarcerating those like Al-Halabi fighting to keep Palestinians alive, a relatable lie or idea, as it were. People can live with accepting, and that is to routinely mid-frame those who are good allies in the Palestinian struggle for justice as dangerous. This is a sort of inversion going on here. The Zionist regime sets itself up as the party at risk of being harmed, which in reality is the Palestinian people, while the party protecting itself from such risk, even when that is by humanitarian means, is framed and also treated like a perpetrator. The Zionist regime and judicial system act in concert. This is no division between them in practice. They are both committed to the elimination of the Palestinian people. And for the governments of the world to maintain diplomatic relations with the Zionist regime, as if this were not the case, is to be complicit. No morally sound relationship can occur with power so intent on destroying life. It, however, is a force that must be fought. No race, not religion, but the animating force of the Zionist regime denying the basic rights of Al-Halabi and countless other Palestinians has no place in the world.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to you all on the 27th of the month of Rajab, which is indeed one of the major Islamic festivals, since this marks the formal start of the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to mankind. So let us ponder on a wise saying from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. You should reward them who do you favors. If you cannot reward them, you should thank them. Showing gratitude is a sort of rewarding.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanul la'inur rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahmanur Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at human rights, and specifically justice, and more specifically justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. Now, when we look back into history, and especially at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and him assuming the position of Khilafah leadership to obviously establish justice and establish fairness and equality and equity amongst the subjects and amongst the Muslims and the people of his time. Many people opposed Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Many people did not take the oath of allegiance. The likes of Abdullah ibn Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas and Abdullah ibn Umar and many others, who in return, even though Amir al-Mu'mineen said to them, you are free not to give your oath, but I require you to keep quiet and stay indoors and not interfere with the affairs of the Muslims and the affairs of the nation. So if you don't want to give allegiance, by all means, but I should not expect you, I do not want to see you in the arena creating fitna, creating sedition and problems for people. Even though there were some other persons and other people who remained hidden in their houses and were inclined to take the oath of allegiance, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi said about them, I am not desirous of those people who do not need me. You don't need me. I don't need you either. I am here trying to serve you. I am here to give you your rights. I am here to establish justice. Three khalifs before me, and you saw what they did. I will do the contrary to that. I will establish the law of Allah and the tradition of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. I will enjoin good. I will forbid evil. And everyone, in my eyes, are equal. Now, that is a thunderbolt to those people. Because before Amir al-Mu'mineen, they were kings of their own. They had wealth, they had fame, they had pride, they had arrogance. You know, they were a class above the rest. They saw themselves to be, in a different league of their own. Now Ali alayhi salam is coming to bring them down from the thrones to the dirt, to equalize them with everyone else, with a servant and a master. How does that work? You can see how Islam has moved and changed after the demise of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam to the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen. It was completely changed. It went back to the paganism era. Even Allah testifies to that fact, and He says, Muhammad is only a messenger. If he dies or he gets killed, you will heed back to your ways. You will go back to the way you were. And they did. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen is coming to them, and he's saying that I am here to establish. So some people said to Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know what? I'm going to stay indoors. I'm not interested in you. And he bluntly said, I do not desire you either. I do not need you. So he left them free on the condition that they would not create any disturbance and would not harm the people, because he is trying to serve the people. And these people now, they are outcasts. These people are an opposition. They have to remain what they are and not cause disturbance to people. Let us take a short break, then we continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about Amir al-Mu'mineen and him trying to establish justice, and now he is in the seat of power, people need to give him their allegiance in order for him to work his magic and give them their rights. But then again, there are always those who try to stand in the face of truth, in the face of justice, and create havoc and mischief and tyranny. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he dealt with them in a very diplomatic, peaceful manner. He said, I leave you be, but do not harm the people, do not cause and create any disturbance. Many revolutionaries wanted to free such persons to take the oath of allegiance by force. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, he had many of his companions who were devoted to him, you know, as we call them, revolutionaries in their mindset. They said to Amir al-Mu'mineen, listen, you're the commander of the faithful. You're appointed by Allah. You're the divine leader of mankind. We can force those rats and make them give allegiance to you. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says, no, that's not how I work. That's not how I do things. Or in fact, this is not how Allah does things. This is not how Allah works. Allah even says to us as servants, you want to worship me, by all means. You don't want to worship me, you're free to do so. I mean, there will come a day where me and you have to have a chat, but you're free to choose whatever you like. So the commander of the faithful did not agree to this, that they should force others to give allegiance. In the matter of the oath of allegiance, his usual attitude was what he said himself. And this is what he said. He said, I shall accept the oath of allegiance from one who takes it voluntarily, and I shall ignore one who declines to take it. That was the statement of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam when it came to establishing justice. That those who want to give it to me, it has to be done voluntarily. It has to be done from their absolute own will, which I don't think that ever happened in anyone before him or after him. Even before the Amir al-Mu'mineen, the first one came by power, with a sword, people had no choice. The second one came by the first one appointing the second one, and the third one came by few others appointing him. So people had never had a say. People never had the freedom to speak out. With Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, you want to choose me, you have to choose me voluntarily, not by force. And you don't want to give it to me, you don't want to give me your allegiance, by all means, I should ignore you. I won't take it from you. That is how justice is applied in the system of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And when people came to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he is the only leader that people voluntarily and with their own free will gave allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen to become their leader and to establish justice. And people done so voluntarily because they saw that the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, was deserving of it because only he can establish justice and create human rights. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran, top promotion of Persian language on global scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran Imruz.
Persian language has been spoken for 3 millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
1,000 years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets. Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoch's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings. An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. It is now well-established fact that animals feel, think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same, life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for 2 decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes. Bonobos and bombos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf. The 16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture. and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Color, beauty, and entertainment. The French city of Nice hosts a dazzling and flashy event. The so-called Battle of the Flowers took place on Saturday. Performers on top of animal-themed floats waved at the crowd and threw flowers at the audience while musicians played live. Each of the 16 floats was decorated with around 3,000 flowers. Also, thousands of people attended the event. The Battle of the Flowers is part of the carnival in Nice, which has been held annually for almost 150 years. An endangered Mediterranean monk seal has embarked on a new solo adventure after spending months under the care of conservationists. Four-month-old Evie was released back into the wild on February 15th in northern Greece. Evie was rescued when she was only 7 days old. She had been washed ashore and separated from her nursing mother during a storm. However, conservationists found the lucky seal and started taking care of her. Even though Evie's health was poor, she recuperated quickly.
She was really dehydrated in the beginning, which is very common with pups that separate from their mothers at such an early age. And the first few weeks were critical for her health because there's basically no way to replenish, like to replace the mother's milk. So we have a certain protocol and a food regimen that we provide along with vitamins and other supplements to the seal. And thankfully, in the first few weeks, she showed signs of her health status became better.
The conservationists hope Evie will be able to join a community of her species soon. They will be tracking her movements with a chip. There are only a few hundred Mediterranean monk seals left in the wild. About half of them live in Greece. Entrapment from fishing, pollution, depletion of food resources, and climate change are some of the threats facing the species.
History shows a gun barrel never stops people from acquiring their learning tools. A bookshop in the besieged Gaza Strip is a testimony as book lovers flooded the store months after it was flattened in an Israeli airstrike. The new Samir Mansour bookshop, funded by an international donor campaign, now stands some 200 meters from its original site. It was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on the west of Gaza City last year. The new shop is spread across two floors and is stocked with some 400,000 books. They range from school texts to the Quran to Arabic translations of European literary classics. Hundreds of people, including writers and Palestinian officials, attended the bookshop's reopening. The store first opened its doors 30 years ago and is considered the oldest and the biggest in Gaza.
The city of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century. Performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix, a fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences, between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, but through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It is crystal clear that NATO has badly blundered. A military organization that had no justification to exist following the end of Cold War in 1991 and the dismantling of its socialist rival, the Warsaw Pact. Its dream of eastward expansion to the borders of Russia might finally lead to its own demise. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden's Third World War Threats Might Destroy the U.S. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. What is happening in Ukraine is an entirely inter-Slavic affair that seemingly required a sort of military operation by Russia as the motherland of the Slavs in order to weed out dangerous elements on its borderlands that were Trojan horses of the West. The United States and major European powers have been clearly stumped by President Vladimir Putin's timely action. But instead of trying to see facts and realities, they seem to have opted for confrontation instead of coordination with Moscow in the interest of peace. President Joe Biden resorted to the same stale American tactics of economic terrorism without realizing that Russia has several aces up its sleeves to neutralize them to the detriment of the West. He's threatening a massive war on the assumption that even if Europe